time for our Eastern Conference grades here on the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I'm joined by Dane LaRue. We'll go through that. We got a little bit of news, nothing too major, that we'll get to at the very end, but we'll just get going here in alphabetical order, starting in the East with the Atlanta Hawks. Your thoughts, Danny?
So I think the place that you have to start with them is the center swap. Functionally, they traded Al Horford for Dwight Howard. You know, you can go a couple different ways with that. I think that's justifiable in a vacuum. This didn't really factor into my grades too much, but I didn't like that the way that they kind of, your theory on trying to save face with that might have alienated Paul Millsap a little bit. That wasn't great, but that's not a big deal. The other big thing they did was trading Jeff Teague for the number 12 pick, which they used on Torian Prince. So I ended up giving them a C-. I thought they did a decent enough job treading water with what they did. I liked Delaney and Jarrett Jack as kind of being possibilities for the point guard. And so, you know, it was fine, but nothing spectacular.
I went with a straight C. I think the center swap is an interesting one. Horford was better than Dwight last year. Dwight was better than him probably the 5 years before that. And they're about the same age. Dwight, by his own admission even, was not defending as hard last year just due to the culture in Houston and his own frustration with the fact that he wasn't getting post touches, etc. I think that those two guys are close enough in production that getting Dwight for 3 years and avoiding that fourth and fifth year of the Horford contract, which they would have had to do, they would have had to give him basically, if not his full max, very, very close, it sounds like, from the reporting on what the offer was. So I think that's actually a slight win. They may be a little bit worse next year for having Howard instead of Horford, although Howard probably addresses some of their weaknesses in the playoffs a little bit better. It depends what they get out of Howard. Obviously, I think the sort of character and winning elements, that's a downgrade from Horford to Howard. Most people would agree with that. So, I mean, what do you think of that exchange when you consider especially that you avoided the two worst years of that contract?
I think it's a fair exchange. Also, as you talked about, the weaknesses, especially in terms of rebounding. Dwight Howard, even in his more limited, you know, times with his back and everything else, he's still a very good rebounder, which is a nice thing for them. My big concern is actually a little bit different, which is that I don't exactly understand what their vision is, because
I was going to say the same thing, yeah.
Because getting rid of Teague for the 12th pick, you know, I think that's a reasonable return. It's fine, especially considering he's an expiring contract. But now they're not good enough to really utilize Paul Millsap in this stage, you know, because he's going to be a free agent. They can either really overpay him probably for years, like he's going to have the same Al Horford problem, or they can just so they're kind of not good enough to really use that now, but they're not bad enough that they can get even close to tanking, and they just signed Dwight Howard. So I don't think that Dwight, and part of I think why I liked what they did is that there isn't an albatross there, as much as, you know, Dwight 2 years from now might not be great. It's not the albatross that Horford would have been. I don't get what they want. And so that's part of the reason I think why I went a little bit below a C, is just this uncertainty. But they also got some value contracts, and I didn't love their draft. I actually pretty actively disliked it, but it wasn't horrible because they didn't waste top picks.
To me, I think the plan is kind of what it's always been in Atlanta since this new regime came in with Danny Ferry and now continuing with Coach Bud and Wes Wilcox. The idea is be as good as we can while not locking into any bad contracts. And I think they still have managed to do that. Now, at some point, you might say they have to take a little bit more of a risk. Millsap is going to be the next question there. We'll see how well he plays going into age 32. At least they won't be able to give him 5 years because he'll be limited by the over 36 rule. He'll be 32 next year.
If that still exists.
Yeah, he could take a significant step back this year as well, and then maybe they can re-sign him for kind of more normal starter money. The fact that Millsap has continued to age as well as he has and even arguably improved last year at age 30, 31 was incredibly impressive. You got to think that ends at some point. I thought that getting the number 12 pick for Teague was good in a vacuum. I think their philosophy in drafting is that there just are not enough wings around the league. And so with Bembry, with Prince, you take as many bites at the apple there as you can. They have a good development system, and they want to try to kind of manufacture those players as opposed to going with bigs. And there, as we've noted before on the Denver section last time, really nobody in that 10 to 20 range other than the Denver guys really wowed you during summer league or was really particularly sexy, I think, even before that. So, and only one of those Denver guys even played. So it's too early to say on Prince or Bembry. I mean, I'm more of a believer in Prince than I am Bembry, just due to, because I think he has a little bit more size and athleticism, a little bit better of a shooter. So it's, I think ultimately they're going to be maybe a little bit worse than they were last year, but they avoided locking into any bad contracts. And I thought the Teague move, at least in terms of getting the 12th pick for him at a time when he's about ready to decline, they can find out what they have in Schroeder now too. All that is kind of a wash to me. I think if I had to pick a direction to go from C, it would be closer to your C minus. But overall, a lot of sound and fury, but not really that much of a change in their fortunes. And I do think maybe this team, you could say, has a slightly higher upside with Howard in the middle than with Horford. But that's, I think their kind of median outcome is a little bit lower.
And I'm amused that the one piece that we didn't discuss of their offseason, the significant one, was re-signing Kent Bazemore, which is exactly the same. They signed him to a fair value. He's a good fit with their team. So it's, again, that's one more like a C signing.
Yeah, we thought that they would actually give him up. But if you look at what other options they had for his $18 million a year, there wasn't much out there. I mean, consider that Alan Crabb got the same contract. Bazemore is a far superior player to Crabb, but he's still young enough to live up to that contract, maybe improve a little bit, although you have to think his shooting might regress some. But that was an okay value contract. It wasn't great, it wasn't bad. That was basically a C signing in what I thought was a C summer overall. And I thought Malcolm Delaney was an excellent value. They avoided getting into the backup point guard market that was so inflated for a time, and getting a player who you could even argue has a higher upside than guys like Augustin or Ish Smith, even if he's not proven necessarily at the NBA level. He was outstanding in the EuroLeague last year.
Sure. So let's move on to Boston. I'll go through kind of the summary. So they added Al Horford, of course, drafted Jaylen Brown and two European players who will not be with their team this year. They let Sullinger and Evan Turner go, and they re-signed Tyler Zeller, and then they recently signed Gerald Green. I think, you want to talk first?
Yeah, I went for an A- with them. I think in the lead up to the offseason, I had sort of said, hey, do you really want to sign Al Horford? Does he put you over the top? Isn't it better to maintain flexibility? But I think I've walked back from that a little bit. Number one, on sort of the whole walk, crawl, run, or crawl, walk, run theorem of things, they got a big free agent to sign with them. They're going to be better this year. They still have a max slot in 2017. If you look at who might have been the double max players, you know, two max guys who would have come there in 2017, one of whom would have been better than Horford, I'm not sure that you have one. They might have even potentially been looking at taking a step back this year if they did not sign Horford, and that, again, would not have been helpful for their free agent fortunes necessarily. I happen to really like Jaylen Brown. I think he was the right pick there. Most people don't agree with me. I understand that, but I got to go with what I think. But I think the Horford signing, you have to say that was their guy. They got him. And at the very least, what they did with him, there's a lot of teams that overpaid for guys who weren't difference makers even this year. And while you can say that could get ugly at the end for Horford, it's only maybe 1 or 2 years at the end. He's going to be worth his contract, you hope, these first couple of years. And he's someone who, again, probably makes them the odds-on favorite for second in the East this year. And then if you have a team that has all these draft assets, got to the Eastern Conference Finals, even if they're probably going to get waxed there, and still has max space, you have to really like their position. So I think Horford was a step forward. Yabusele, I did not really care for at all at 16. I think it seems like he was sort of drafted for his stash ability. But if you look what they ended up really doing, they had plenty of room where they could have just brought over whoever that was this year. As it turned out, I think they should have figured out a way to make that $1.5 million work instead of just prioritizing stashability with Yabusele. I don't think that they believed he was necessarily the best guy there. I certainly don't believe that. I think there are a lot of guys who could have helped them much more than him. Zizic is a guy I think can be a solid backup center prospect someday, a guy who plays hard, but probably doesn't necessarily have a starter upside. And their second rounders, Jackson, might have some potential as well. The Zeller, getting him with the non-guaranteed second year was solid because now he's tradable. If they had just signed him to 1 year or he had taken the qualifying offer, then he would have been untradeable. And of course, they maintain their flexibility. So with all that, I thought A- for Boston. not really that much other than those second and third first rounders that I thought they could have done better on.
I give them an A minus as well, and for a little bit of a different reason, but it's kind of an analog, and that is that they were able to get a quality player. And I think that Boston's window, depending on how they see it, they kind of have two. One is a near-term window with guys like Isaiah and Horford, and then there's kind of a long-term window with the Nets picks and Jaylen and all that kind of stuff. And by getting Horford without giving up any of those assets, that allows them to consolidate, if that is what they want, they can consolidate those assets into something really significant. And that is great because they can build a really good team out of that if they want to, or they can just use those and draft them and kind of try to burn the candle at both ends in a way of being good now and then having those future assets if they want to go that way. But if they want to, you know, go after Russell Westbrook, trade for Gordon Hayward, sign him outright, you know, whatever they want to do, they can. They have the assets now to make that happen. I don't think they're going to go after Boogie, but they can. And so I think that that is all good. The no bad contracts thing, Horford could get questionable, but only being allowed to sign him to a four-year deal makes that a lot more palatable than what Atlanta was facing. And I think that's notable in this case, and part of the reason why I was the one on this podcast stumping for them to sign Al Horford. And then the draft, I didn't love Jaylen as much as you did, but I think he looks better now than I expected. He was more in line with your projections, and he's fine. You know, even though I didn't have him third, I still thought he was a talented player. And I was, again, like Yabusele, I didn't love that pick, but it wasn't horrendous. Given everything, it would have been fun to see them take somebody like Scal, whatever. I'm not going to really downgrade a team for something like that. And more than anything, I think the most surprising thing is that they didn't cash in anything this summer, but I don't think that was a bad thing whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, you never know how big those Jimmy Butler talks got. If it was just the third pick for him, again, it's probably a deal you would have wanted to have made. But I think maybe the Bulls probably wanted more than that, and where that line got cut off, who knows. Also, on Horford, he actually has a player option for 2019-20, so it's even possible, pretty unlikely, you'd have to say, it making $30 million that he opts out there, but maybe he could, and he saves him from that last...
he would do that if he wanted to get big years somewhere else. You know, that's the type of time that you can see somebody opt out of a year is when they want years instead of annual value. Kind of like Dwight. I think Dwight was a good example of that.
So we're going to get to the Brooklyn Nets, the ultimate franchise to tease, before we do a commercial. And that commercial is for the Ring Video Doorbell. The Ring Video Doorbell is an inexpensive way to find out what's going on at your home when you're not there. There is a home burglary every 13 seconds, and many of them happen in broad daylight with a burglar just ringing your doorbell, see if you're away, and then if you are, nobody answers, they break in. So with the Ring Video Doorbell, now there's a deterrent effect there. It just goes straight to your smartphone using advanced motion detection technology. It allows you to see and speak to anyone approaching your door using your smartphone. Their kit also includes a Ring stick-up cam, which is a wireless weatherproof HD camera that lets you keep an eye on another part of your property as well. They both install in minutes, and working together, they can provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home. If you're in the living room or if you're thousands of miles away, I travel a lot, obviously going to various events and covering games, and the Ring Video Doorbell gives me peace of mind. And of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if my listeners did not get a discount. You can get $50 off the Ring of Security kit by going to ring.com/capspace. Capspace, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And if you do that, you can join the hundreds of thousands who protect their home with Ring. Ring.com/capspace for $50 off the Ring of Security kit. What'd you have for Brooklyn?
So my focus for Brooklyn, and this, you can go back and look at my writing and this podcast, has always been the idea of building a long-term asset base, that considering the obligations they have to Boston, what they do in the near term is less relevant than what goes on in the long term. And I gave them a D because I don't think they did much to build that long-term asset base. They signed reasonable contracts, Lynn, Gravis Vasquez, and all that kind of stuff. But they really, like, when you say, okay, who's going to be on this team in 2019-20, they didn't really add much.
Well, they avoided screwing up, which is a lot more than a lot of teams.
Well, partially because Portland matched. Like, I mean,
so that would have been 4 years.
I didn't really add that factor that into my grade, but they dodged a bullet for sure.
Yeah, you could say so. Although, again, it's not like they're in a situation where nobody's really taking their money at this point. So spending, I mean, what do you think is a reasonable contract for Crab? Like $13 million a year? Is that what he's going to be worth? $14 million a year, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, 14. 14's about what I'd put it at. And, you know, that's, yeah. I understand why they had that impetus. I like the Tyler Johnson one more myself. But,
Yeah.
I mean, I think that also part of what bothered me about their offseason was that after those kind of things, I thought they were a little bit uninspired. You know, like Mo Harkless would have been, even as a vengeance thing, like I think he was a little bit underpaid. And so you not only make Portland sweat, but I think, you know, maybe you would have gotten him. And just trying some things more like that. And I was also really bothered by their kind of low-end signings, guys like Anthony Bennett and Joe Harris, who just have really limited upside. And so I know that the market for what I call the Hinkie special, which is a minimum or near minimum contract with non-guaranteed future years, there was so much less leverage to have one of those. But they didn't go young, really, in that kind of a way. And trading Thaddeus Young for the 20th pick, I thought that was selling a little bit low, especially considering the well-acknowledged flaws in this draft. It wasn't a terrible trade, but I thought it was on the low end. And then taking LeVert, who is talented, but we don't even know like if he's going to play and like how, if he can ever even reach the level he was early in college. So I think that it all kind of fits together in the sense of, you know, if your goal was to be was to be better and not script the future, that's fine. But that's only part of the direction that I wanted.
I went for a C with them. I thought Lynn was an excellent contract to get him for $12 million a year, likely only for 2 years, is good. I mean, he was probably the best available free agent that realistically could have come there at his position. And they actually avoided overpaying him quite well. I thought the Tyler Johnson offer sheet was one that made sense and ended up getting matched. Crab, I understood what they're doing, trying to get some more shooting, and not a huge opportunity cost to do that. Granted, it ended up getting matched. So, and that was Trevor Booker, I thought was somewhat uninspired. You know, I would have much rather 2 years, $18 million for him. Like, why wouldn't you offer a little bit more for like a Gerald Henderson type if you're just trying to get good? Randy Foy, good vet, so maybe there's that, but not a ton of youth on this roster to really mentor. Justin Hamilton, I thought, was excellent from Valencia. His statistical translations were really good. He had played well in his last year in the NBA. I agree with you on Bennett and Harris, pretty low upside guys at this point. Scola, another kind of good vet, but you know, between to spend $13 million on the power forward position and really get nobody even approaching a starter level player was a little bit of a disappointment.
And no one with potential.
Yeah, that's right too. Grievous Vasquez, I thought was good again, but just on a 1 year deal to just kind of get a little bit more playmaking, some passing, someone who can do something off the dribble was helpful. LeVert, I don't really have an opinion on, didn't see much of him, didn't get to see him in summer league, so I'll just assume he's your normal number 20 pick. And Thad Young, yeah, maybe you could say they could have gotten a little bit more for him given that he's under contract for two more years. So again, they didn't screw up, which I liked. I think a lot really depends on what they end up doing with Brook Lopez to really determine the future of the franchise.
Yeah, I certainly think that's true. Charlotte was one that I really had to go back and think about because they did some really good things, but...
Oh, one other thing, actually, we forgot to say. Kenny Atkinson, who they hired as a coach. I liked him. I think so. He has an excellent reputation in player development. We'll see how much of that actually applies to strategy, personality management. I know that Jeremy Lin really believes in him, and he said on JJ Redick's podcast that had Atkinson not been there, he probably doesn't sign that contract. So you can look at that at least as one person he's had some influence on. Atkinson has gotten a lot of credit for Hawks University as well. They don't have a ton of moldable young talent on this team quite yet, but they're starting to get a little bit with Rondé, with McCullough, LeVert. At least they're getting a little bit now in the coffers with those kind of guys. So I think for a young roster, for where you want a guy to take a risk on, I thought that he was a decent hire, you know, so he was a positive for me as far as that C was concerned. All right, so let's get to Charlotte.
With Jeremy Lin's former team. So what the Hornets did in the kind of big picture thing, like if you look at their two biggest moves, I think both those were successes. So they not only retained Batum, but got him to take a pretty significant discount, which is massive. And they got Marvin Williams to take a...
Well, hold on. I don't think it is massive because they screwed up and basically should have started him at $26 million this year and done descending.
That's true.
They're not going to have any space this year. So there's like the fact that they saved $7 million or whatever, I guess $6 million. He starts at almost $21 million this year. His cap hold was 19. So you basically only get an extra $2 million in spending power this year. They could have started him off at almost $27 million, his maximum, and then done declining throughout the rest of the contract because they're not going to have space next year. We've talked about this before, that you could then have more space as he gets to the end of that contract. It would match up with probably the decline in his performance. He's 27 now. It'll probably get worse over the life of the deal. And then you'd have more room to sign free agents. So the only reason not to do that basically was kind of cheaping out and spending less money this year. So I downgraded them a little bit for that. There's probably a little bit too much on something that's not going to make a huge difference, but that was frustrating to me from a cap management standpoint, where you had this lower cap hold and they just didn't take advantage of it in any way.
Yeah, you're totally right. And the other one, like, kind of cap move was that they got Marvin Williams to sign using the early bird exception, which has kind of allowed them to do some of their other moves. And I'm fine with that. It was something we dealt with in the mock off season. However, while you were right to talk about the Batum thing, the move that bothered me the most was at the draft, which is when they traded the 22nd pick for Marco Bellinelli, which was, in my opinion, significantly the worst trade that has happened during what would be considered this offseason, because Bellinelli was, in my opinion, a negative asset, or at least real close to it, and they gave up a pick for it, and that actually really hurt their cap flexibility.
I would say Orlando trading for Ibaka was the worst for me, just because it's so much bigger, but I agree with you just in the sort of how inexplicable it was. Yeah, that was really bad. And I also thought they could have made more of an effort to retain Courtney Lee if they had just kept the 22nd pick, not taken on Bellinelli, and then they had just not gotten Roy Hibbert. And I think Spencer Hawes is not a great backup center, but he's fine. And you also have Kaminsky, too, who theoretically should play some backup center, at least against second units. So if they had just not made that trade, they would still have the 22nd pick. That's way better than Bellinelli. And then they could have kept Lee's cap hold on the books, paid him up to as much as they wanted to, maybe even just done 3 years for him instead of the four that he got with New York. I think he was actually a really important player for them that they're going to be losing. Maybe it was just that they felt like he wasn't going to start for them. I still think they should be starting MKG at the four, especially because they have a guy next to him in Batum who, if MKG is going to guard the big wing threat on the other team, Batum could guard most fours. Okay, he's skinny, but he at least has a lot of size. So that was, I thought that.
And then you can slide, if you really need to, you can have Marvin play in those circumstances. You know, you could have those four guys kind of man the minutes there.
Yeah, I think Sessions is about as good as you could hope for at backup point guard with the resources they had available. And I think they got a second year non-guarantee on him at $6 million a year. So that was a solid contract. And it's actually a team option rather than a non-guarantee. But in this case, functionally the same. I did not particularly care for the back end of the Marvin contract. I don't think they used the early bird exception to fit him in, and so they had to give him the years for that. 4 years, $54 million for him. I think it's going to end up being bad by the end, but they did get him on somewhat of a discount, you can argue. And then Lynn, it didn't really make sense to retain him at his price. He probably wanted to go somewhere and start anyway. But, you know, with Walker coming off some health problems, backup point guard is a concern. I ultimately went for a C- with them because I felt like the trade was so bad for Bellinelli, and then just letting Lee go when they had his bird rights at only a $9 million cap hold, and then also not doing a descending contract with Batum. I thought Hibbert was an okay value play. I like bringing Christian Wood as a guy with a little bit of upside, but I think they could have just managed things a little bit better, but they're not material worse, at least this year, for it. So C minus is where it is for me.
I give them a B minus. I thought that they did a reasonable job of kind of dealing with some of the expected losses. I agree with you that they could have changed the Courtney Lee situation, but Sessions, not only at that contract, is reasonable. I agree that Hibbert was unnecessary, but it's still a fine contract. It's not really bad in that sense. And I hated the
trade. And he could provide us some real, if he has a renaissance, he could provide them with a great second unit defensively.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that he could, you know, if he plays well, he can factor into some stuff. I'm not completely sure that he will, but it's good to see that. And considering they had limited resources for various reasons, like they had a very constricting summer just in terms of everything that was on the table, I thought they did a reasonably good job of keeping it together, though they kind of got in their own way again, which is frustrating because they've done that a couple times in recent past and they could be even better than they are.
Well, so B minus, were you thinking just because they got, the good things that they did to me were bring back Batum and Marvin at like slight discounts. Other than that, everything else to me was like a slight negative.
See, I like Sessions quite a bit for what they got him for. Okay. Like I thought that was, I mean, it shouldn't be this way, but I thought that Garrett Temple getting paid what he did actually in some ways kind of helped with the way I thought about Sessions, because I was around, like, I've been around the Wizards a little bit, and that was ridiculous, just the fact that the disparity in those contracts. And, you know, basically their goal to me was to kind of keep it afloat. And I think they definitely did that. And so I'm okay with that, given what they had. Because there are some teams where it's easy to keep together, and there are some teams where it's hard. And when they're unrestricted free agents with low cap holds, I can respect that it takes something. But yeah, I don't know. I can see the logic of going lower with it, but I thought that they had a hard job and they did an okay job of it.
Yeah, they lost Al Jefferson too. Nah. I don't think that spending $10 million a year on him would have really helped much. But this is a team I think is, without Lynn, without Jefferson to a degree, I think Marvin's going to take a step back. Batum had by far the best year of his career last year. He could take a step back. These guys could struggle to score a little bit more than they did last year. Let's get to Chicago. I had a D-.
I give them an F+.
Were you inspired
nope,
by my
I had an F+ in there. I actually hadn't even realized. I wasn't sure if I'd given it a D- or an F+, but I had that in there before, you know, because I did all these before we recorded the first half. And the big problem for me with this team is that they created a kind of a Frankenstein's monster of a 2016-17 Bulls squad that can actively antagonize their best player, who is also their best contract. And that is baffling.
Although their best player, the Butler, did recruit, he and Rondo recruited Wade. I mean, I think once they were at the point that they were at, bringing in Wade was fine. It was everything that preceded that I thought was so miserable. First of all, the Rose trade, which a lot of people lauded at the time. I thought it was bad then. I think that everything that's happened since then makes it even worse. I thought they had a very simple path to potentially getting back to being at least in kind of contention for the middle tier in the East, as I've said before, by just signing one of the better defensive centers on the market, getting the best backup point guard that they could, and then just trying to run it back, and maybe even trying to bring back Etuan Moore as well, although he ended up perhaps being out of their price range, so I can understand that. But and instead signing Rondo, I mean, that was just like, I don't think Lopez is, you know, I think he's a below average starting center, average at best. I don't think he solves any of the problems that they had at center, really, because he's too slow, not good enough defensively. Rondo is just such a bad fit everywhere. Attitude, age, defense, lack of shooting, having to have the ball in his hands. He was a terrible fit with Butler. And if they had just gotten like a normal point guard who could actually shoot the ball and then brought in Wade, you'd feel a lot better about where they were at.
Yeah, they created a team that doesn't make sense in the short term, just in terms of how their offense, and I think more importantly, their defense is going to work. Their defense is going to be abysmal. And so you have a team that's pretty easy to defend because they just don't have threats in that kind of a way. And so, yeah, I said when the Rose trade happened that I gave it a tentative positive grade because I thought, oh, well, if they react responsibly to this, basically still doing what your plan was, if they had still gone in that direction of getting a center and doing all that kind of stuff, maybe moving on.
Yeah, you're never going to sell me on this. Hey, trading for Robin Lopez and then still signing another center.
Right.
When we already have a center making $14 million a year is a good idea. You're never going to sell me on that.
I know, but that was my logic. And the Bulls did not apply it. And I didn't really expect them to, just because it's counterintuitive in a lot of ways. But yeah, they kind of set. And what concerns me is that they also weakened their future just by, you know, tying up all this cap and guys, and the possibility that they get kind of trapped with Wade like Miami has been the last couple of years. But I'm not sure the Bulls will be good enough to get trapped.
Yeah, this year there wasn't much opportunity cost for the $25 million that Wade is making, but it's a little bit less than that. But next year there could be, and he's going to be 35, probably will not be worth that contract. Now, if he recruits some awesome star to come here next year, then maybe, but then they would still have to move on from Rondo to open up a max slot next year. Also, I thought also that having to give up 2 seconds to dump Jose Calderon, that's pretty ugly. Those actually could be pretty good seconds. Those are a Denver 2018 and their own 2019. Denzel Valentine, what did you think of him as the pick at 14?
I don't see the pathway to him being a starter. He does some nice things in terms of being able to handle the ball. He has a kind of a calmness about him that I like in terms of being poised, but he's not good defensively and his jump shot isn't reliable enough. So getting a rotation 2 who struggles defensively at the 14 pick, even as weak as that was, I think you could at least go for a swing and a miss as opposed to something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Valentine, like, what's he going to grow up to be? Like, Grievous Vasquez, someone like that? Like, a slow guy, 6'5", 6'6", and maybe he'll be a better team defender than Vasquez, a little better shooter, but still sort of a slow guy who has the ball in his hands and can't really get to the rim and finish. I think also the fact that they don't fit Hoiberg's system at all is another issue. The fact that all of these huge egos and personalities don't really seem to fit into Hoiberg's lack of fire, shall we say, that, which is something that was an issue, at least for some people last year. So, yeah, D minus is where I end up with. I think that they are worse, much worse this year than if they had just completely stood pat and just used their money on the best center available, even for 1 year. And same thing with point guard. So the fact that they made it more complex, they encumbered their 2017 space more, and they got worse for this year. I mean, that's really checking off all of the boxes on how you get to a D minus.
It certainly does. Cleveland. This is actually, I was very surprised that our mutual friend Kevin Pelton was praising their offseason, because I actually am very critical of their offseason, and there's a specific reason why. So my grade is an incomplete slash a D, and the reason it's an incomplete is because they haven't actually signed LeBron and JR. So we don't know, but, you know, until those are in, do it.
Yeah, we'll make the assumption for yes. these purposes that they will.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why that's kind of what the D price is in. And so the reason for me is very simple. Cleveland is a one goal team, and that goal is beating the Golden State Warriors. And of course, the Warriors getting Durant is not Cleveland's fault. It's nothing like that. That is not factored in. However, that was a constraint that Cleveland had for basically the entire offseason. And I thought that they did a horrendous job of using their resources with that goal in mind, because what they did was they had the taxpayer mid-level exception, they had a bunch of trade exceptions, and then they ended up creating one of those also with Dellavedova, which I'll get to in a second. And what they have done with that is they have retained Richard Jefferson, they have added Mike Dunleavy, and they brought in Kay Felder. None of those guys are particularly useful, as good as RJ was this past year. I wouldn't trust those guys in a series against the Warriors.
Yeah, Jefferson, at least bringing him back, I felt like that's something that they had to do. And he was good, at least, against the Warriors
sure.
last year. A lot of this depends on what you view as their ultimate goal. If they're just going to get better in the regular season, I think Dunleavy helps them there. The failure to address backup point guard at all is definitely a concern for the regular season, maybe less so in the postseason when they could just have LeBron be the backup point guard. I thought not matching on Delly was a tough call, but probably the right one if you're looking at it through a more Warriors-focused microscope. But yeah, I agree with you that nobody they got really is going to help that much against the Warriors. But I also think that the fact that they maintained their entire $9.6 million Varejao trade exception, which expires in February, right about the trade deadline, while also getting Dunleavy, they couldn't have done that without not matching on Dellavedova, because then they had the salary to send out to get the trade exception that they then took Dunleavy into. So we'll see, still maintaining that trade exception to get someone who might actually really help against Golden State is probably the triumph of their offseason. I don't think that they lost anybody who would have helped against the Warriors, and I also don't know that there was anyone available. I mean, because that's the question for you, is you didn't like what they did, but what really could they have done? What do you think they kind of gave up on?
I mean, we didn't even really see them go after kind of upside plays, either in terms of like young guys with potential, you know, in that kind of way, just basically.
All right. So, yeah, who would that have been, though?
Like Christian Wood. Like, as crazy as that sounds, you know, just go after somebody like that who's talented, or a make good contract.
Yeah, he's not going to help this year, though.
I mean, he's
no chance.
Well, maybe he's not going to help this year, but at least then you have a chance. And also the thing with Dellavedova, which bothered me, is that, yes, they added Mike Dunleavy. Congratulations. But really what Dellavedova was costing them, because they were already capped out, like functionally speaking, as long as they retained the players we assumed, really all that cost them was Dan Gilbert's money. And it mitigated some of the worst case scenarios, which is putting a lot of miles on LeBron if Kyrie gets hurt in the regular season. Yeah, I again, on the Warriors focus, it's not as important, but it's not like the contract he signed was horrible. It was a fine contract. And if considering where the point guard market is going, I think that if they had needed to get out of that in the future, they could have. And yeah, he didn't play in the finals, but he was still an incredibly important part of keeping their heads above water during that stretch of time, which, I mean, that was something that we discussed back when the season started about, like, oh, how are they going to do without Kyrie? And the answer was, you know, okay. And that was, you know, that was great. That for what they needed, they locked in the one seed. And you're right that, you know, they did have limited tools to get better. And I firmly believe that their trade exception is not that valuable just because they don't have other assets. A trade exception is most potent when you can combine it with something. And, you know, some CBA news are going to be like, you can do it in trade. They don't have assets.
They have Chetty Osmond. They have some first rounders in the future that
eventually
they look to move. I thought getting Kay Felder at 54 as just someone who looks like he might be able to play, that was decent. And I also think that getting Dunleavy and keeping the full $9.6 million trade exception was worth the price of losing Dally, who, again, I don't think makes a huge difference with the Warriors. So I ended up giving them a C+, just didn't have a ton to work with. Maybe you could say if they had tried to go in with the full mini mid-level, Chris Anderson is a waste of space. I don't know why they bothered with him. But to try to get the full mini mid-level with Jefferson. And then also they're bringing back James Jones, too. It came out today, who, while he is a great locker room guy and LeBron loves him, you got enough of these vets already on the team.
It's their whole team.
Yeah. So, like, they really should be trying to find some guys who can play like they successfully did with Jordan McRae last year. You want to try and find another couple of guys like that when you're capped out in perpetuity the way these guys seemingly are. But what did you end up giving them? Like,
I gave him a D, straight D.
A D, yeah. Yeah, C+. Plus. I mean, we'll, and this grade won't be complete until we see what they do with that trade exception.
And what if they give JR ridiculous something? Because, of course, LeBron signing him is not a problem.
Detroit, I went for a D+. Plus. For them, I was not a huge believer in Henry Ellenson with the 18th pick. He's also highly redundant with some of the other guys that they have. They re-signed Drummond, but they had to give him a player option. I thought that Boban at his price was a decent flyer, although he's already 27. Not a fan at all of the Ish Smith and John Luer signings. And their biggest need was a backup point guard. And I'm not sure that Ish Smith, despite a three-year contract, solves that.
I give them a C-, and the biggest concern is something that you just touched about, which is that I saw their strongest need as being playmaking just in general. And, you know, guys that can do that, because really it's Reggie Jackson and then hopefully Tobias Harris, depending on how everything goes. KCP doesn't really do that. Marcus doesn't really do that. Stanley Johnson doesn't really do that. And so they're very reliant on a guy who isn't particularly great at that. You know, he's fine, but he's not great. And they had resources. And so spending some of that on players like Boban is fine. I thought I was, again, okay with that contract. Ellenson is one of the guys in this morass who was taken in a spot where I didn't love him either, but there weren't a ton of guys that were a lot better. And my big concern beyond the identification of their biggest need is that they also spent a lot of long-term money again. And while the argument can be made that, oh, they weren't going to have flexibility next year anyway and things like that, the Pistons know better than almost anybody that having long-term money on your books that is unnecessary and undesirable can be a big problem. They're still paying, they still have Josh Smith on their books for more than $5 million a year. Like, these kinds of things add up. And even though they aren't a free agent destination, doubling and tripling up on kind of the same need is problematic, especially when Anthony Tolliver got a really reasonable contract.
Yeah, I thought maybe bringing him back was something that they could have done. And some of what they did this year kind of throws that how bad that Aaron Baines signing was now, because they got two guys now that they felt like they needed to upgrade on him for. And so you've got $24 million tied up in John Luer, Boban, and Aaron Baines. That doesn't really seem ideal. And then throw in Josh Smith's stretch, and you've got basically, you know, $28 million tied up in guys who are, you know, maybe good backups at best, I would say. Probably not even average backups. That's not really that great. And then they're going to have to give KCP a raise pretty soon, and they could actually get into potentially some tax issues next year and beyond. And that would seem like a little bit of a shame if you did that so you could get guys like Luer and Boban and Baines and Ish Smith on your team. And I would have much preferred that rather than throw $11 million at Luer and $7 million at Boban, that they just spent all that money on a backup point guard, maybe even someone who could play with Reggie Jackson. And Deron Williams is not a guy who has the greatest reputation in the world, but at least I think he's someone who could have been pretty good, and they could have easily beaten Dallas's offer for him. Maybe he wouldn't have left because it's Dallas and that's where he's from, and he's still getting paid by the Nets and all that stuff. But I think they just, for Ish, 3 years, $18 million, they just could have done better with a guy with some more upside or who was more established. I would have rather had probably Ramon Sessions even than Ish, and he was only $6 million for 1 year, basically, in guaranteed money to Charlotte.
They also have this weird situation where they made a big bet against the way the league is moving, because they got slower, they got less versatile in terms of switching. You know, like, they got all these centers. Like, Boban is a great manifestation of this. He's a talented player, but he's fundamentally limited in terms of his impact, particularly in a playoff.
Yeah, they got four centers on this team now. I mean, Lure is definitely better at center. He's like, he's really can shoot the ball at the four, but he's not like such a great shooter that you're just freaking out over shooting at the four, and then he's going to be too slow to defend other fours. He's not a guy that where you're worried about putting a wing on him. So you just have all this tied up in the center position, and I don't really understand that that wasn't a huge weakness. They have a guy who's a star center on the team already.
Yeah, and if you have a guy who's a star center who's versatile in that way, maybe you have one guy, you take one contract and have them be a change of pace. And then, I mean, a lot of teams I think are going to be going smaller at the five, and they're just, you know, you can play guys off the court. And yeah, I it was a strange identification. I think that's the biggest issue I had with them, is just like, oh, well, obviously what the Pistons need is to get bigger. I mean, nobody really thought that. And yeah, they added some shooting, but they didn't add, you know, monster shooters in that way. And it's sad because I liked Lure, but they just gave him too much money.
They did give up Jody Meeks for nothing to Orlando. That was a good move because Meeks apparently is now going to be out for months. That he's basically dead money, so they got that off their books, $6 million. But then they didn't exactly.
Congratulations, you know, Orlando.
On the space. We'll move on now to Indiana. But first, a message from the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. This is one of my favorite products that we do ads for because I just found it independently. I thought it was really cool. I ended up getting in touch with the CEO, going to try out their prototype at their offices in Redwood City, which is right by me. And I was really wowed by what this thing does and really proud to have it as just a cool product that's available that I can introduce you guys to. The way it works is you step onto a scale that rotates you 360 degrees in front of a mirror that has scanners embedded in it, and it is able to stitch together a 3D model of your body based on that, send it to your phone via their app, and you can have a ton of information about your body. You can compare it to past scans, see where you're gaining muscle or losing fat. You can find out what your body fat percentage is accurately, which is more than you can say for some other methods. You can compare and see whether you have any imbalances between your left or your right side. All of that is just something that really has not been available at home before. It is a device that used to cost upwards of $10,000 in health clubs. Now you can get it for $300 off the eventual $1,000 price, and then save another $50 by going to naked.fit/capspace. It's going to be available in the spring of 2017, but all you need to do to preserve that discount of $300 right now is to put down $95 basically as well. And once you sign up, you get your own referral code, and then if you share it with your friends, and if any one of them buys it, you get another $50 off, and so do they. So lock in that great price for a product that's going to revolutionize your fitness. I'm really so excited to have this great product on the podcast, and you can order yours at naked.fit/capspace. What'd you have for Indiana?
I gave them a D, and I like that you just used the phrase locked in, because I think that's what they did, is they built this incredibly strange team, and depending on what they do with Jeff Teague, which is going to be another complication, it could be a mistake that compounds on itself, kind of like we worried about with the Jeff Green thing with the Clippers, which didn't happen. So in summary, what they did is they swapped George Hill for Jeff Teague, they traded the 20th pick for Thad Young, then they lost Jordan Hill and Yan Mahimi, and signed Al Jefferson and Aaron Brooks. So they have a team that is, you know, and they also hired Nate McMillan to replace Vogel, which I think of as a downgrade.
Yeah, I think that's a massive downgrade, personally.
So I feel like the point guard swap was a mistake. It takes away from their identity. They really don't have many defenders on this team anymore, and they also don't have a ton of real shooters, unless you believe that Jeff Teague's shooting last year is for real. And they gave Teague a lot of leverage in terms of his next contract, which presumably gobbles up a lot of their cap space. And so the they're also in a weird position now for 2017 because they have all this money tied up and they didn't have the money to renegotiate and extend Paul George, which is a problem. And then they thought, you know, oh, we need to play faster. And then they give what I call a 2.5-year contract to Al Jefferson.
Is there anyone on this roster now who is an above average passer for their position?
Maybe Paul George.
Say Paul George. Yeah, that's got to be it. And then for shooting, you would say maybe Paul George would be the only one. CJ Miles, who's probably going to get buried this year, would be the other one, but even he hasn't shot the greatest percentage. So
if they start Jeff Teague and Monte, that is going to be such a magnificently bad fitting backcourt, and they're going to be putting a lot of strain on Miles Turner as well.
Yeah, on both ends, I think that's true about Teague and Ellis. So Larry Bird's strategy seemed to be like, let's get as many guys who are high usage and have high points per game on the same team. And while that might have been good analysis for 1995, it wasn't even for 2005, and it's definitely not in 2016 now. I don't know why I picked 11 years ago and then 10 years before that for my example. But nonetheless, I think it's just, if you don't have passing and you don't have shooting, it is very, very difficult to be, I guess Miles Turner, you could say, is an above average shooter for a center.
Yes.
But I don't think this team's offense is going to be that good. I think their defense, they've added a lot of defensive liabilities, especially that Ellis and Teague backcourt, Al Jefferson now. Turner, for all of his gifts, I don't think just with his ability to execute, to get on the floor, defend and pick and roll, I don't think he's going to be much above average as a center. You really look like Paul George is your only, I guess Thad Young, you could say, too, is pretty decent.
And also, one thing I want to mention with Turner is he can be a little bit foul prone, and that's going to be a major problem on this team.
Yeah, I thought that, then you're going to have Al Jefferson playing against, you know, I don't think that their system is going to be as good as it was in Charlotte to hide him the way it was his last couple of years. Thought at backup point guard, they really didn't get anyone who could set people up. It's Aaron Brooks, Monte, Joe Young, still all those guys are score first guys at backup point guard. I thought that Young for the 20th pick was a solid move. They needed a solution at the four, but then the Teague trade and not moving on from Ellis, not getting more shooting. I don't think Al Jefferson helps them that much. All of that, I think they started off really well, and then they really just went downhill after that.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And so I had a D for them as well. Miami, I actually think they did better this offseason than a lot of people would say. What did you think?
So I vacillated on grades with them within the C variance because I think basically what they did is they held firm. You know, they in a way, like, so re-signing Hassan Whiteside and Tyler Johnson, I was fine with both those. I know that I'm higher on Johnson than you are. But Whiteside, you know, he was a talented guy at his price. They weren't going to get a discount at center. And then the Wade thing is the Wade thing. And they were going to lose guys like Joe Johnson and Wall Deng anyway. I don't really grade them out. It's kind of similar to Charlotte where I wasn't too critical of that. So you have those kind of as constraints, let's say. I thought what they did was fine. You know, they got all these kind of one-year flyer guys, and I thought they did a reasonable job with who was available and who would accept that in a very narrow window. But they really didn't add much in terms of future assets, and I just don't think their team was, they made their team that good. And yeah, getting Dion Waiters for the room exception is a nice value contract in that way, but he doesn't fit perfectly with Dragic and all this kind of stuff. So I ended up giving them a C minus, but anything in that range, I'm fine.
Yeah, I went C plus. I think the conception of what their offseason was is based on how much you value the loss in perception of the franchise overall because Wade left. Does losing Wade just kill them, prevent them from getting anybody good in 2017? I don't think that they are actually that much worse this year for having lost him as long as Dragic can stay healthy. I mean, one of the things that was so ridiculous last year was that Wade had, you know, a 38% usage and Dragic's was single digits in the last 5 minutes of close games. And that despite Dragic being a more efficient player who also probably sets guys up a little bit better. I think that Dragic can take on a fair amount of the role that Wade had. And I also think I was encouraged very much so by what we saw from Josh Richardson in Summer League. I think that this team can be really, really good defensively now with all the athletes that they have in the wing who are going to be getting a lot of time. And I think if Bosch plays 70 games, I think they're a better team than Chicago, who Dwayne Wade went to. That may be damning with faint praise, but I like that they're letting the young guys play. They can now make it look like they have a pretty good young core. You're going to be empowering Whiteside for good or for ill. And the only probably regret that they have is that they couldn't get into kind of the one-year bargain guy market a little earlier than they did, because Wade didn't make his decision until later. But if you're going to give Wade guaranteed money of $25 million a year, $30 million a year in the summer of 2017, I think that just they are much better off just on the basketball floor in the long term by not having signed him to that contract. The problem is going to be now if just nobody will go there, because it looks like they kind of screwed Wade over. And it definitely was, I think, a failure in communication for a team that is legendary for all these cap shenanigans, that they could not actually get Wade to agree to sort of a wink-wink deal that would have kept his cap hold low in 2017 and then allowed him to bump up his salary with bird rights. Yes, that would have been illegal, I get that, but there's kind of an expectation they might be able to pull that off with some of the crap that they've pulled. And it sounds like now reporting from Ira Winderman is that Beno Udrih has a standing offer to return for them whenever he wants it. Big surprise after he sacrificed the $90,000 that kept them out of the tax and let them sign Joe Johnson last year. So, but I think ultimately a C plus. I think that they are better off for having not signed Wade to that contract. We'll see whether the intangible effects of that end up proving me wrong. And Willie Reed was a good.
Willie Reed was the best of their bargain plays, in my opinion. Waiters is the most interesting in that way and arguably the most talented, but I think Reed getting the chance, depending on how their center rotation works out, he could be a nice fit. A team that was not as cost effective with their centers, the Milwaukee Bucks. So the Bucks signed Dellavedova and Mirza Teletovic. They drafted Thonmaker and Malcolm Brogdon, who they've recently signed. They re-signed Miles Plumlee, and then they lost Jared Bayless and Gravis Vasquez, to no surprise. I gave them a D-. We actually lampooned them when the Miles Plumlee trade signing happened. For the big conceit for me is that they gave up a ton of resources, not really picks in that sense, but they gave up a lot of resources. But I guess you could include Thonmaker. You know, he was drafted 10th. And I don't think that they answered any of their big questions, and they really cut into their future flexibility.
Yeah, let's look at the rubric for what we normally grade these teams on. The first question that you always start with is, will they be better this year? I think that unequivocally is yes. Delly, while they gave him a lot of years, they didn't necessarily overpay too badly for him in a vacuum. And I feel the same thing with Teletovic too, the 3 for $30 million for him. Not too bad given what some other people in that area were making. And they've got some more shooting as a backup four now. He can play with either Jabari or with Giannis pretty well. Delly, again, can play off the ball while Giannis handles it. Can defend the other team's point guards. He'll play hard. He shoots pretty well on threes. We'll see whether his offensive competence was the result of just being on the same team as LeBron James. I think he could really fall off a cliff. The Plumlee move, obviously, was really bad, I think. And in the aggregate, just the lack of a plan to not maintain future flexibility for a team that is very young and that you also don't even necessarily know what you need around them in the long term, that was worrisome. They let Gravis Vasquez go, who, you know, that was the right move. But, Gravis, he signed in Brooklyn for 1 year, $4 million. How much would it have taken to just bring him back for another year instead of signing Delly? Is Delly really that much better than Gravis? Like, Gravis is probably a better offensive player than Delly is. I mean, I guess there are some concerns about Gravis's health. But yeah, they traded a first rounder for Gravis Vasquez, by the way. One, you know, basically a third of a year of Gravis Vasquez because he got hurt. That was pretty ugly. I like the Thon pick, though. What did you think about that?
It's fine. I think that he has a ceiling depending on what his...
Like, who would you have taken over him?
Yeah, because that would have been early for Hernan Gomez, and he's not a perfect fit with their team. It's a little bit dirty to say Scal, but I mean, I love Scal, so...
Yeah, but, yeah. Although, and there could be something out there that we just don't know about Scal as to why he dropped that low. But I thought Thon, he certainly looked a lot better than pretty much anyone who was drafted after him. And I assume that they drafted him having a good idea that his age is at least close to what it's listed at. And if that's the case, I think that actually could end up being a really solid pick. We've talked about why we like him before, at least I have. But to me, just the reason I went with the C- ultimately is just, well, they did get better this year. That doesn't really mean that much when your core guys are so much younger. And this is the exact type of team to me that should have just sat out on this market. I think if they had gone for kind of stopgap guys, the Vasquez rather than Dellavedova thing being an example, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that specifically, that they wouldn't have been that much worse this year. and you still could have kind of chilled out and seen what you needed. And then if everyone does really well, then maybe you can start really getting into the market for 2017. They basically are locked in now, and they haven't really changed the ceiling of the franchise at all. So that's why I went with the C-, even though they will be better next year. And a big part of why it wasn't lower was I thought the Thon pick was good.
They also, we talked about it with the Pistons, they have so much money tied up in not clearly starting caliber centers, and they don't really have the means to add another one unless they're going to throw, if they miss the playoffs, another lottery pick at it next year. And, you know, it could work out if Monroe, you know, even if he just leaves of his own volition, that those guys are a big part of the answer, and maybe Thon can play a little center. But you don't know that. You basically paid Miles Plumlee like you know that he's the answer when he isn't, and they also just gave that money to John Henson, and I'm not sure either one of them is particularly tradable in the near or the long term as well. So it could be just one of those persistent things, kind of like New Orleans messed up center situation.
Yeah, this is they have almost $40 million that they are paying the centers this year, and not a single one of them is even above average. Like, that's a little scary. And then another way to kind of think about their offseason is those three guys, when I say there are three core guys, Middleton, Parker, and Giannis. Let's say you have those three guys, and what are those guys making combined? Those guys are making combined maybe like $23 million or so off the top of my head. And with the entire rest of the money that they have spent, which with Plumlee's low cap hold, that's, you probably got $75 million bucks worth of money on the entire rest of the roster. You don't have a single other above average starter. That's pretty remarkable. And
just, or even a young player who there's a reasonable belief, I mean, maybe with the exception of Thon, that they're going to reach there. Like Malcolm Brogdon's a talented guy. I like the pick too. But he's not going to be the answer to those remaining questions, especially because he conflicts positionally. So unless you were going to play him at the kind of the Dellavedova role of being off the ball but defending ones, which is possible. But yeah, they kind of swung for the fences with Thon, and I'm fine with that. But yeah, I mean, they've committed to a team that they hamstrung their own future for guys that aren't good enough to justify that. And that ties in actually pretty well with the next team, which is the New York Knicks. And I gave them a D, which is probably harder because, again, like you use the rubric of are they better? The Knicks are unquestionably better, but they spent a ton of not only present money, but long-term money, which is why I hated their offseason, on a group that is unworthy of the potential that Kristaps Porzingis has.
I went with a D+. I think if they had just, rather than signing Noah, just gone for a cheaper stopgap option at center, or even brought in another wing and then brought back Galloway too, and then just committed to playing Porzingis at the five. I mean, that's another thing that really is too bad. And I think Rose with Porzingis at the five could have really thrived, because the thing about him now is he can get to the rim very well, but he just can't finish there. And so if you're playing with Joakim Noah, now you don't have to guard him, so there's always going to be someone there, and he's not going to be able to make his layups. And his vision is not amazing, Rose, compared to a lot of point guards. If you're playing him with Porzingis at the five, now Rose can become a much more dangerous player. Now, they probably needed another center, but there are guys in a much lower price range. Like, what about, look what Nene signed for, you know, or Cole Aldrich, or they're just signing Noah at 31 to $18 million a year for the next 4 years is just, I mean, that's not a good use of your money this year. I thought just Courtney Lee was a fine signing at his price. I think he'll be probably overpaid for maybe the last year or two of that deal, but a two-way guy who helps them now, totally decent starting two guard for maybe the next year or two at least. I think they actually, I could have really, really liked everything that they did were it not for the Noah signing, because I'm on record as saying that I really liked that Rose trade for them. So why am I giving them a D+ if they only had one bad sign? And don't forget, Brandon Jennings was really good too. One of them was the Kristaps Porzingis thing with him being marginalized. I think that losing Galloway was inexcusable for, like, the fact that they wouldn't match that contract, just keep his restricted rights on the books, and they could have matched that contract from New Orleans if they had wanted to, or close to it. $6 million a year for him, that's like letting him get away doesn't really make any sense. So yeah, and then if they had just maintained flexibility for next year, not brought on Noah, just brought in a one-year stopgap at center, then they could have had almost $50 million in space next year with that's without Rose on the books. But still, they could have brought back Rose and maybe even had a max slot as well. And now they're just going to have a declining 32-year-old Noah, who, while he is good on defense, and I think their defense is going to be pretty good now, is just not going to be good enough offensively. And I think with him at center, they're going to kind of struggle to score. And then if they decide that he's not going to close games, he's too prideful. He's going to be upset about that.
And they spend a lot of long-term money on guys that are on the bad end of their age curve when their most intriguing young player is, you know, just touching it. So that means 2 and 3 years from now, when Porzingis is getting closer to his prime, they're committed already to this group of guys that are going to be worse than they are right now, physically and just overall. And that's really bad. So a note that I had was of the high-end rotation players they signed, because of course they did add some young guys, Willie Hernan Gomez and a couple others, that the youngest player of the high-end rotation guys they signed, including re-signing, is Derrick Rose, who turns 28 before this season.
Yeah, they now are assuming that they just have to bring back Rose, and they will have flexibility next summer if they want to get another point guard or another max guy who actually wants to come there. And maybe they play well enough that they could do that. But the most likely scenario, you imagine, if they do, especially if they do well, is that they just bring back Rose, and now they're kind of capped out a little bit. And now you've kind of wasted the time where you had a lot of flexibility while Porzingis isn't making much. And you're going to get into now these Noah deal, the Lee deal, Carmelo's deal still, although he might opt out. Those all continue on into where Porzingis is going to get expensive. So you've kind of lost the ability now to add around him other than what you added this year because of the fact that he's so cheap for the next 3 years. I thought the Lance Thomas contract was decent, but even if they had to have a center under contract for 4 years, high end of the market, I think Mahimi or Biombo would have been a better option there. But yeah, I mean, just think of all the guys that they could have gotten just for a year, 2 years, less than $10 million. Aldridge, Azealy.
I mean, given him that same contract, he would have had a lot more visibility. He would have basically been locked into a spot. I mean, you couldn't have guaranteed that he was going to get that low, but you always knew. We talked about this when we did the mock off season, that there was always going to be somebody. I mean, we actually had it being Timofey Mozgov, but there was always going to be somebody that was going to wash out of this market, and the Knicks are a very visible place. And center was not a thing of priority for them because they already had Porzingis, and you know that was kind of
And they had Aldridge already. I guess they didn't really care for him, so maybe it's not realistic that they would have brought him back. But
they there was somebody. You know, the center market is saturated with players, and they even already have Kyle O'Quinn. You know, he can sop up 15 minutes if you want to go that direction. He doesn't start, but I think starting Melo at the 4 and Porzingis at the 5, and then having somebody spell Porzingis and slide him over is a more realistic evaluation method than playing him at the 4 full time.
Also, using a roster spot, giving guaranteed money to Marshall Plumlee, it's not really much indication other than his last name that he can be an NBA player. I did think that the Hornacek hire was better than I expected.
Yes.
But now the question is, are they going to still force him to run the triangle? And are they going to play triangle with like two guys who can't shoot at all? A pick and roll point guard in Rose? He's going to play triangle now? Like if that's what they end up doing, that's going to be a total disaster too. And they're not even having a so-called triangle expert. Not that there are many of those out there anymore. I went D+ for those guys. The Orlando Magic, I also went D+ for them. They had quite the dichotomy of a lot of moves that I really liked, and then some that were really head scratchers.
I gave them a D-, and the term that I used was two solid signings: Fournier, less than max, Biombo, two semi-value trades, and the rest was a disaster.
Yeah, I think the Ibaka trade really just smacks of, oh my God, we're going to lose our jobs. You know, that is really probably the biggest moral hazard trade of this offseason, where you're going to have to massively overpay him on a 5-year deal to bring him back, most likely. And, you know, he is a better fit with Vucevic, but then there was the plan always that they're going to bring in Biombo after trading for Ibaka. Maybe that now can be an awesome defense, but I still think their best center on their team is probably Serge Ibaka right now, and Aaron Gordon. While the point was made to me in Summer League that Gordon is better defensively at the 3, even though he's probably better offensively at the 4, and you don't really have another guy on the roster. You've thrown into this a couple of times with guys like Aminu or MKG or Gordon, where it's like you want to play him at the 4 on offense and then have him guard the other team's best wing threat. Well, then who's going to guard the other team's 4? You don't necessarily have another combo forward on the roster who can do that. So that is somewhat of an issue. I mean, that's kind of why I liked Harkless in Portland because he and Aminu could, either of them were big enough to guard the other team's four in a pinch. A lot of teams don't necessarily have that. So that's, at least defensively, it makes sense for me more that you're going to have Gordon at the three, and that defensive lineup of him at the three and then Ibaka and Biombo could just be a ridiculously tough defense to score against, and Payton too could take a step forward defensively. Offensively though, I just see no way that these guys are ever going
to
score.
Oh, so you mean signing DJ Augustine to a four-year guaranteed to a four-year contract isn't going to resolve any of their offensive issues?
Yeah, that's another one that really did not make much sense to me. Jeff Green is basically just throwing $15 million down the toilet because he doesn't have any kind of a role on this team after you signed Biombo to him. There just isn't space for him in the front court. Is he going to play 10 minutes a game? Like, why not? If you wanted to do that, like, Brandon Jennings signed for 1 year, $5 million in New York. Why not bring him back for 1 year, $15 million? You know,
renegotiate and extend with Serge Ibaka. Like, that money could have been used in something like that.
Yeah, they probably had an understanding that that wasn't going to happen
probably
with him. But especially considering Ibaka's age at 27 ? He probably wants to get out of the market and get the longest deal that he can. But yeah, that Green, I mean, there's just, I would have much rather had like a Gerald Henderson than Jeff Green, for example, at that price. They could have gotten him. The Meeks trade was horrendous. Did they not know that he had this foot issue already? They basically just have wasted $6 million on him. They spent $21 million on guys who are probably going to play a combined 10 to 15 minutes a game for them this year. And then Augustin, that contract you mentioned, is pretty ugly.
They let
too, with
Dedmon go for nothing. Like, they could have just even retained him and traded him for a second round pick, you know, or kept him because he's actually a good basketball player.
Yeah, I mean, they had his restricted rights. Like, why not just like make at least keep him on the qualifying offer this year, if nothing else? He wasn't taking up much space at all. It's not like, you know, thank God you got Jody Meeks, who can't play at all this year, so you can lose Dedmon. You couldn't hold on to like his, you know, $1.2 million cap hold or whatever it was. I think this idea to have Aaron Gordon handle the ball a lot, that which came out in Zach Lowe's article about them last week, that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, having run a pick and roll with him, you can just switch it. He can't shoot a jump shot off the dribble. You can just go under on him every time. Like, there's zero evidence whatsoever that he can be a guy who's going to create offense for himself or others.
And they're not getting four spacing at the one anyway. You know, like, you're not getting some of the surplus benefits of something like that because, you know, it's the same issue that Milwaukee ran into with some of the lineups they were throwing out there.
Yeah, so I thought that Vogel at the coach was really good.
Yes.
That was... a big part of why this isn't a worse grade for me. He was one of the best coaches available on the market. And I do think he is positioned to get the most out of this offense challenged, but potentially defensive monster lineup. I thought that getting Evan Fournier on 5 years, $85 million, I don't know how they bamboozled him into taking that. You would have to imagine Fournier would have had max offers out there for 4 years that would have been for $94 million over 4 years, and he could have gotten a player option instead of 85 over five, but he decided to lock in for whatever reason. That's about it, really. I think it's just, I don't know that they're even that much better this year. They probably are. This is probably, you know, at least a top 10 defense, if not even necessarily a top five defense. So they could even challenge, you know, the best defense and the worst offense. And they may be, in fact, the worst offense in the league. Maybe only the Sixers might be worse than them at this point. I have to really go through and see. But they're definitely got to be a bottom five offense at this point, you would have to imagine. Yeah,
there isn't really a theory of how their offense is going to work also, because they can't. It's even hard for them to put out a five-man lineup that will have a good offense.
Yeah, and Vogel is not someone who's really gotten much out of teams that were probably more talented offensively. They had a superstar in Paul George, and they still had, you know, offenses that were in the 20s most of his time in Indiana. Yeah, so maybe they'll be a little better this year, but they trade away Oladipo and Ibaka. I would say there is at least a 50% chance, if not more, that he is not on the team after this year. Again, this is kind of, all right, you know, maybe they make the playoffs after 4 years wandering the wilderness. And maybe that saves everyone's jobs, but you're taking away probably still, I think, their prospect with the highest upside was Oladipo.
And they also traded the 11th pick in that trade.
Yeah, that's right.
Sabonis,
too,
who was somebody who I think we both liked.
I don't really care for Sabonis that much personally. I mean, I think he could be a rotation guy, but I don't think he can be a starter just due to his limitations on defense at either big position. But all right, let's get to Philly. What'd you have for them?
I will read what I wrote verbatim because I think this is the way to do it. I gave them an A-. Nailed the draft and brought over Saric, but I cannot in good conscience give a team that signed Jared Bayless for 3 seasons a straight A.
I gave him a B, but similar logic. I think, you know, Simmons, they made the right pick there. I don't give him a ton of credit for that one. The Bayless deal was horrendous. I thought that Gerald Henderson on his deal was fantastic. 2 years, $18 million, second year, non-guaranteed for him at age 28 was great. So they didn't, and Bayless, yeah, he doesn't, that third year is kind of ugly. I would have rather just gone, you know, probably 2 years, $25 million for him than three for 27. But nonetheless, they didn't screw up their future flexibility too badly. Getting Sarge to come over this year while he's still on the rookie scale instead of next year, which probably would have made more sense financially, was a coup. I think that Korkmaz is an excellent pick at 26. He's a guy who could be a pure scorer for them, provide some shooting in the long term, which is something that they lack. And then Timothy Luau-Cabarrot, I think, is an athletic guy who could maybe turn into a 3-and-D type of player someday at 24. I think a guy with some pretty good potential there. I wish that they hadn't just lost Christian Wood, but they just don't realistically have any space for him to develop him. And I think no matter what happens, they're going to have so many centers on the team anyway. And I think they also at least avoided making a bad trade with either Noel or Okafor. We'll see what ends up happening with those guys. That logjam theoretically has to get eased. But until you know that Embiid can make it through at least half a season healthy, I wouldn't be in a rush to trade either of those centers right now.
Especially when you would be selling low, particularly on Jahlil Okafor. Like, you would be, not Joel Embiid, you'd be on Okafor because of what happened with last season. Like, if the offers weren't there, then you just can't force it. You know, if a team had made, you know, something ridiculous, and we don't know what was on the table and what was not, but absent that sort of, like, no-brainer type of thing, I think it's likely that the market was cooled on him just like it was on all these centers. And why I think it was an A-minus is just that bringing over Saric is huge. Like, that, getting him on a four-year rookie scale, on the low rookie scale that we have right now, he's a very talented player. He can make an impact right now. And other than Bayless, of course, it's a lot easier to do one bad contract when it's below $10 million and your team has no money expended on anybody else. And this isn't a criticism of their offseason, but it is something worth watching, is the center logjam gets a lot of attention in Philadelphia for good reason. But there's a burgeoning power forward logjam there as well, assuming that's where they want to play Simmons and Saric. So I would be interested to see in whether they're going to move somebody like Jeremy Grant, who is a great value on his contract, but just doesn't necessarily fit perfectly with those guys. And so whether they can get value for somebody like him or Rashawn Holmes, like these players who are certainly pieces of a successful team and incredible values due to the contract Sam Hinkie signed them to, but just moving them before they kind of trough out if everybody plays.
Yeah, but hey, these guys could have potentially two top six picks again next year, you know, with that Lakers pick that's only top three protected, and also their own pick. But hey, you know, Sam Hinkie definitely deserved to be fired. Toronto, I gave them a C-. Here was my rationale. I thought that with the number nine pick, where they are, you're a team that doesn't have a lot of chances to really shoot for the moon. And Jakob Poeltl, though I believe he could even turn into a lower-end starter someday, he doesn't have much in the way of offensive upside. I think he's not quite quick enough defensively to really be an elite defender. And they already have Valanciunas for three more years. And so maybe you could say he protects them from losing Valanciunas. But then Poeltl will only have a year before he gets expensive on his rookie contract as well. I mean, I don't want to downgrade them too much because, you know, differences of opinion on the draft, that's not as concrete as between established NBA players who have track records. But I would have liked to have seen them shoot for the moon here, because just getting a good backup center, I mean, we've already seen that there are a million of those guys available in the league these days. And you have Valanciunas already as a centerpiece, who presumably is going to be playing a lot of minutes. And I don't think even Valanciunas has so much trade value that you're like, oh, if Poeltl develops, we can Poeltl, I guess is how you say it, we can trade Valanciunas and get some King's ransom. Sully with the mid-level was good, I think. And then it boils down to, what do you think of giving DeMar DeRozan a five-year, $145 million contract at age 26?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that. how I would summarize it is that it was justifiable but not proactive. And so what Toronto largely did is they kind of saw the playing field and they just played the hand that was in front of them. And that was disappointing. And one of the reasons why, and this was something that I hadn't really pieced together until I wrote this, despite writing another piece about how they could have done something more with the pick before it happened. I talked about Gallinari as a fit or something like that, is the Kings traded down from the pick that was Marquise Chris because they didn't really have a need for him. And it's not like they got this massive amount from the Suns. I think Marquise Chris, even though he's a distinctly imperfect player who probably wouldn't have helped them too much in the short term, that would have been a much more interesting bet than what they ended up doing. And Poeltl is fine. You know, I'm not sold that he'll be a long-term starter. I could be wrong.
He's not changing your franchise, yeah. And I don't think, having him on the team.
I wasn't the biggest fan of Marquise Chris. I've been pretty open about that. But at least he has a high ceiling, and there's the possibility that he's a game changer. And if it wouldn't have cost that much, and we know it wouldn't have because they actually did make a trade, and the 9 pick is substantially better than what the Suns gave up, even though, unless they really liked Bogdan Bogdanovic, who didn't come over. And so they just didn't do much with that. And Sullinger, you know, fine thing. It doesn't really add to their long-term asset base.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good value, sure. But they only have him for 1 year again, too.
And then so they're not, and again, unless it's awesome, they're not going to be able to re-sign him. And with the payment to DeRozan, and assuming they're going to bring back Kyle Lowry, and even really, realistically, even if they don't, they don't have much flexibility moving forward. So this is pretty much the Raptors team we're going to see. And yes, they finished second in the conference and made the conference finals. And that is a wonderful development, both for team and city. That is realistically as good as it will be, especially when Boston, you know, got a lot better and has substantially more ability to get better in the future. So if they're happy with that, then okay. But I even think if that was their rationale, swing for the fences with something, with anything, really.
DeRozan, I think I would have ultimately bitten the bullet and let him go, or tried to get him for a lot less and then maybe let him go. Now, again, I'm not in that market. I wasn't in the building during game 6, as the fans were, you know, even bringing LeBron James to comment on them, chanting, "Let's go Raptors," as they're getting blown out by 25 in game 6 in the finals. I don't have to deal with Kyle Lowry, who obviously believes that DeRozan is a good player as well. Lowry can be a free agent at the end of next year, though he'll be 31.
Do you want to sign him to his next contract?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what that contract ends up being. But I still would have let him go because I think he just isn't that good. And wasn't that good in the playoffs necessarily when he's guarded by good defenders. He is 24th in RPM among shooting guards. Not in the whole league, among shooting guards.
When he's a bad defender, like, that's the other part of the DeRozan thing, is his offense is a mixed bag. Some people like that mixed bag, some people don't. But objectively, he's bad defensively. And so when you think about how that's going to age, it's terrifying because players don't get better. You know, it's not like fine wine where they get better defensively as they lose their physical ability. And his offense is predicated on things that are not only unsustainable or hard to sustain now, but will degrade with time. Like, I think betting on him is a poor one in that way. I absolutely would have let him go unless he was going to take a discount. And you take the Kyle Lowry wrath, and I understand that there is this weird parallel to Charlotte of, you know, oh, you had this season where you had these positive signs and all the kind of stuff, and obviously Toronto had a much better year, but you're not going to reach those heights again in all likelihood, and now you're committing to a team that isn't nearly as good as, like, long-term as the team that you just saw.
This DeRozan contract and his All-Star selections, while we can talk about a lot of the revolutions that have come in evaluating basketball players, the old way is still very sticky. I mean, we saw that with the Pacers. DeRozan is definitely better than a lot of those guys in the Pacers, but he has a 30% usage rate at slightly above average efficiency, and he almost never turns it over. And he got a little bit better with assists. Nevertheless, he is useless without the ball in his hands because he never shoots threes, so you can just help off of him. And as you mentioned, he's really bad defensively, and he's just not a guy who, if the other team has any kind of good wing defender, his whole ISO game is going to work against it in the playoffs. So with that being the case, it's just because he scores a lot of points per game that he still is very overrated as a player, and I don't think that losing him would have hurt them that much this year, and then you still have a lot of flexibility going forward. But ostensibly, this is the fourth best team in the league. That's not really true, but they were a Final Four team last year, and you want to keep that team together. But this is just a contract that I think is not going to age very well. 5 years, I would have bit the bullet and moved on if I couldn't have got him to take, you know, maybe $100 million over 5 years, and it's very unlikely, you would imagine, that he would have taken that.
Yep.
So yeah, that's why I went with the C minus for them. Ultimately, I just think that that contract is not going to work out that well, but at the same time, it's not like it was inexplicable.
Yeah, I give them a C minus as well.
Yeah. So last one, Washington Wizards, your grades are
D plus. And that,
interesting, we really disagree on these guys because I had a B minus, but let's hear what your rationale is.
So going back to something that you've talked about, did they get better? To me, the answer is no, they didn't get better.
I disagree with you, but okay.
They lost Jared Dudley, they lost Nene, they lost Ramon Sessions, they lost Garrett Temple. They replaced the point guards with Trey Burke.
Well, hold on, let me stop you there. Did they get better? You have to compare not what those guys did last year, but with what they were likely to do this year. And sure. I think all those guys were, especially Nene, was potentially going to struggle. But all right.
Okay.
Sorry.
So what they built out was, you know, Jan Mahimi, who I like a lot and I thought was a reasonable contract, but directly conflicts with Gortat because I don't think you can play them together. Nicholson, who's fine. I was surprised at how positive people were on his deal because he only showed really flashes in Orlando, but, you know, he's a reasonable guy. I don't have too much opposition. Satoransky, from what I know about him, think that's a good contract. Reasonable, you know, not much money, about $3 million.
3 years, $9 million for him.
And then
they still have him restricted at the end of that too.
And then Jason Smith for another one of the most inexplicable contracts of the offseason, because why do you need him, especially even if you see him as your backup center, he's not that good, and they gave him years. And then also Bradley Beal, I understand what, especially considering the you know, if you could say the sacrifice, considering the risk with his injury stuff, but giving him 5 years and just kind of like letting it go in that way, there is a lot of risk there. And so the question, I talked about this with Adi Joseph when he did Real Jam Radio with me, is it clear that you would rather have him for 5 years than a 3+1? And I think that you would, but I don't think that's definite. So I think,
and that's the offer that he would have gotten, sure, you're saying, as a restricted,
absolutely,
free
agent. So if he gets that, you know, the offer that Harrison Barnes would have gotten if the Warriors hadn't done what they did, you know, if he had gotten that offer, actually, yeah, nobody signed a max offer sheet, but that what that offer would have been is, you know, that I think that's, it's a definitely, because it's a risk mitigation thing from the Wizards standpoint. And, you know, John Wall still signed for, I think, all of those years. But so what they've created is this team that has their power forwards are Markieff Morris and Andrew Nicholson. They're still incredibly shallow on the wing, despite having that. And to me, the biggest issue is maybe that their backup guard situation is horrifying, and they have two guards with injury histories.
I disagree with that. I think that with Burke and Satoransky, those guys, yeah, they're a little unproven, but they've got some upside.
If Burke has to start more than X number of games, what chance? Like, if Burke has to start 5 games this year, will the Wizards win any of those games?
Yeah. Well, I'd rather have him than Sessions. I don't think that he's really that much worse than Sessions, and they're paying him less. I thought that was a good trade. I think Satoransky.
Yeah, that was a fine trade. I have no opposition to the trade of trip.
Yeah. Satoransky is 6'7", so he can play off the ball on the wing. They've got Beal at shooting guard also. And then, yeah, small forward, I think, is a definite weakness between Porter and Oubre. You got to hope that one of those guys can really start to step up. I think that when you look at where they were after Horford agreed with the Celtics, Mahimi was probably the best guy left on the market at that time. And I think since he's 29, he buys them some more time. Because Gortat, I think this was going to be his last year really as an acceptable starter at his age, which I believe is 32. So he'll be 33 next year. I agree with you that Jason Smith made absolutely no sense. Scott Brooks at coach didn't move the needle for me in either direction. I think he's a record of getting his teams to play hard. Also, not necessarily the most open to new thinking strategically. So I thought he was just kind of an average coach. They maybe overpaid for him, but that doesn't matter. I think that the one thing that I really disliked other than Smith was not just keeping Dudley's bird rights and paying him a ton over 2 years. Like, why not just pay him the same $15 million that he got, or the same $30 million that he got over 3 years in Phoenix, over 2 years in Washington by keeping his bird rights. He was only, I think an $8 million cap hold. If you just don't sign Smith and move another couple of things around, you easily could have still had space to hold on to that cap hold and then sign him. But I think they actually did get better this year. And I liked a lot of their kind of buy low moves. I mean, it's not, I give them a B minus, not like amazing, but I thought that Mahimi was a good signing and they did the best that they could other than the Dudley thing, other than the Jason Smith thing. So that's why I went for a B minus.
So if we make the assumption that they don't trade Gortat in the near term, do you think that situation works out? Because I don't.
Well, what's working out? I think that Mahimi and Gortat both get into foul trouble a fair amount. You're paying those guys a lot, but I think they're both guys who, when they're playing hard in shorter minutes, can be more effective. And they have Markieff Morris still to play at the four. Morris can play next to each of those guys just fine. I'm just the big question for me, again, is what else would you have done? And this is a team where you don't get on them as much about not maintaining flexibility because you have Wall getting into being, really his prime now. You've got some older guys on the roster. Beal, this was the one year that you could take advantage of his low cap hold and still re-sign him. And I'm fine with giving him the five-year deal too. I'd rather have him for 5 years than DeRozan, for example. I think getting that fifth year, I would rather just gamble on that actually working out okay than potentially losing him earlier because he is really young. I think he's still only 22. Maybe turns 23 very shortly. So you're getting him through 28. That's like, a guy's prime. I don't know what better talent they're going to be getting for that money. So yeah, I mean, what was the alternative to what they did is my question. I mean, I think I'm that B minus is in context. Yeah, Mahimi is not an ideal fit, but there was no one really on the wing who you could have given that money to who I think is as good of a player as Mahimi.
Harkless, I don't think he's as good as Mahimi, but he at least gives them some potential. He gives them some defensive versatility, which is a
yeah problem. but again, remember the timing issue, right? This is July 2nd. Al Horford has just agreed. Everybody is coming off the board. You don't know whether, the Crab thing hadn't happened yet. The Leonard thing hadn't happened yet. You're going
to
wait.
Well, they didn't have to do, there wasn't a time piston on them like there was on the Heat with Tyler Johnson, because Bradley Beal had already come to that agreement.
There wasn't going to be anyone left to spend their money on if they didn't spend it right then. That was my point. I mean, Mahimi,
no, but what I'm saying is even if you gave them Mahimi, Nicholson and Smith would have, like, that kind of flexibility would have been enough to do something with that was a little bit more ambitious than those guys. And Mahimi,
they should have just kept Dudley's cap.
That would have been fine. Do something else with that. Accurate. Mahimi, the only issue there is kind of alienating Gortat, and I don't think he's so good that you have to worry too much about that. I do think they're going to have a problem moving him. And as you said, there is an issue in terms of foul trouble, and you could also talk about injuries with that, that at least you're getting competent play at that position, which is good for them. But I think that you talked about how it's important to use John Wall in this sense, and I do agree with that. And I believe that they have a forward rotation that is not worthy of that, and their centers are fine, but you can't really fix their forward issue with that. And that will be a big problem for them. They have these two talents, and if they can use Satoransky well, that would really kind of help balance their backcourt rotation. Scott Brooks is a great example of how to creatively use a backcourt rotation to manage the strengths and weaknesses of all of his guys. That has never really been something that he's done. And I like the idea of playing Satoransky with both Wall and Beal so separately, so play Beal in that role that they've used him in before. I don't think Scott Brooks is going to do that. I think that's an unrealistic thing. And so then if you're playing Burke and Satoransky together, I think that's fine, but it's not, I don't think it's setting the world on fire in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I do think I agree with you that they could have done better with that kind of $11 million at the end between Smith and Nicholson to try to just throw that at just somebody who could play on the wing or keep Dudley or something. But that's why I gave him a B minus. I thought that given what they had to work with, that they did okay. So let's kind of take stock of where we were for the season. I wrote down all my grades. I wanted to see whether I was a huge pessimist. I think most people would agree with me on that. I had pretty close to a normal distribution. In fact, I had zero straight outs. I only had an F plus, which was Portland. And then I had three A ranges, Golden State with an A plus, Utah with an A, Boston A minus, and then everything. So it's kind of, and I agree in that with that too. I kind of give out fewer A's, fewer F's, you know, it's kind of a normal distribution. And I think I had almost half the league was some C variant.
One thing that was surprising for me was that I had very little in the B range, which is something that I actually generally do. Like, I think last year I had a fair amount in that range where it's like, oh, you know, you did a fairly good job, but not an amazing job. But this year, I just think that there weren't that many teams that really ended up in that boat. Like, we just disagreed on Washington. Like, they were a team that I didn't have in that range. And there were, I think, a small number of teams that did really well. So I actually had, I think I had seven A's, A variants, A's and A minuses. I don't give A pluses. And that was more than usual. But those teams generally, some of them were teams that did less and did it well. And that to me is an easy way to get an A. Just like I give a great draft to a team that, like, let's say only had the 20th pick and nailed it. You know, that sort of a thing. There were a couple teams, like, I would say, you know, kind of like Phoenix maybe was in that range where they, you know, they basically just drafted their draft picks and signed Jared Dudley. But I gave them an A minus because that's a pretty damn good job. So yeah, those kind of things. And then there were a fair amount of D's and F's, not an egregious thing. I had a lot of C's as well, but those were, again, teams that just fundamentally misused the opportunity they had in various ways. I think Orlando is a really good example of this, of a team that just did it badly, and the Lakers could be another one as well.
You know, I thought a theme as we go through here of some of the ones that I liked the least were of young teams that I felt like weren't there yet, but had good young talent, and then gave up a lot, or if not all, of their future flexibility to not really move the needle on their long-term picture as a franchise. So you could put Portland in that category. You could probably put the Bucks in that category. Orlando, I didn't like their young talent as much, but I think they kind of did some things that didn't make a ton of sense.
New Orleans is different, but that's...
Yeah, I thought New Orleans did a decent job. Who else would I put in that category? Maybe the Knicks a little bit, just because you have Porzingis. Although that's maybe a little bit of a different situation for them. But yeah, those are the ones that I kind of look at. And then again, then you have Boston, a team that was arguably better last year than any of those teams that we mentioned, that easily could have just spent to their heart's content to try to make themselves as good as they could this year. And instead, they still maintain flexibility. So it is possible to do that. And that's why it was disappointing for some of those other teams that I mentioned.
And it was also frustrating because some of the most exciting future teams got there because of that sort of restraint. I would say, you know, to a degree, the Warriors did that. Of course, the Utah Jazz have done that. You know, the Jazz have all these guys on value contracts, and they had one of the best summers of anybody because they knew where they were going to go. And so they got players that made sense with that. They took Dial, was one of the best trades of the offseason. Not a lot of long-term money, gave up no assets to do it. And they handled, so they did the first step better than a lot of these teams, and then did the next step better than just about anybody.
So let's just go through, because this podcast has taken forever, and just remind everyone of what our grades were. I had a C for the Atlanta Hawks.
C minus.
A minus for the Boston Celtics.
Same.
C for the Brooklyn Nets.
D.
C minus for the Charlotte Hornets.
B minus.
D minus, and you were an F plus for the Bulls.
Yep.
Cleveland, I had a C plus, and you were a D plus?
D, straight.
Ah, straight D. Detroit, I had a D plus.
C minus.
Indiana, I had a D.
D.
Miami, C plus.
C minus.
Milwaukee, C minus.
D minus.
D plus for the New York Knickerbockers.
Straight D.
D plus for Orlando. You know, a lot of D pluses, it seems.
D minus.
Maybe it's
D
just
minus.
In the East. D minus. B for Philly.
A minus.
C minus for Toronto.
C minus. Yeah, same C minus.
And the Wizards, we actually, is that the one we differed the most on? It was the Wizards. I had a B minus and you had
a D plus
in the D range.
Yeah, I think so.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know that they moved the needle.
Yeah, I think it was they were one of those teams that didn't do a lot. And so it was just how you had to evaluate a smaller number of moves. And we just disagreed on a couple of them, even though we agreed on the biggest one, which is actually maybe what makes it really interesting.
Yeah, I think for me with them, it was just that thinking of where they were after Horford turned them down, which they had to really maintain flexibility to try to get him in the fold if they could. that I thought they recovered reasonably well after that point. And that's why I kind of, I don't think they're going to be awesome or something this year, but I think just being in that position that they were in, losing out on Horford was kind of a no-win situation because a lot of players had already agreed, and I thought that they recovered well enough to at least get guys who would help them. And then what they did at the lower end of the backup point guard market instead of overpaying, I thought was useful as well. You got anything to plug before we go?
Actually, before that, I want to mention something that I think is important with this, which is that we are taking, in a lot of these cases, a long-term vision with it. So let's say, for example, we both criticize the Knicks. We both think they're going to be better next year. So this isn't a situation of, oh, you know, we criticize the Knicks offseason, we think they're going to suck. We don't. We don't think that. And so,
well, unless they get hurt, which is an ample possibility.
Which is ample possibility. But the point that I'm making is basically that this is very different in many circumstances than an evaluation of the team at the present. I mean, some of the teams that did the best or did the worst are, you know, on opposite ends of that present. I mean, Denver's a really good example of that.
Yeah, and the more young talent you have, the further away you are from contention, the more, to me, what you did to bolster your future played into a larger part of the grades, as opposed to, you know, a team like Cleveland, where it's really all about how much better did they get this year.
But in terms of plugs, I'm a little bit light right now. I'm working on a bunch of stuff. I might actually write on what I thought was a great experience at Adidas Nations, which we were both at over the weekend. And I have Warriors material coming out. I have a bunch of sporting news stuff as well.
All right, sounds good. Don't forget about our sponsors, the Ring Video Doorbell. You can get $50 off that Ring of Security kit by going to ring.com/capspace. And of course, the Naked 3D Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. Find out more about them at naked.fit/capspace. You can follow me on Twitter as well at NateDuncanNBA. We're actually probably going to start live tweeting some games for the Olympics. I hope to be back later this week with an Olympics preview with someone who has been following that stuff a little more closely than I have, especially the qualifying tournaments. And follow Danny on Twitter at Danny LaRue. Also, the iTunes reviews or ratings are much appreciated, as are any sharing on social media, or just send your friends a text about us if you know anybody else who might like the show. Thanks for listening. Talk to y'all next time.